Hi, this is Alan Chartok. In our first hour in conversation with Phil Lacovara, we talked about his involvement as senior counsel to the special prosecutor during the Watergate scandal. Everybody else wrote a book. He didn't. This is his book. In this second hour, I begin by asking Phil Lacovara who gets to argue the case before the Supreme Court justices.
Well, that was another point of some tension. Leon, I think, had argued one Supreme Court case earlier in his career. It was a civil case. He knew that there was going to be a lot of subtlety to the issues that I've outlined, issues that were novel, somewhat hard to understand. This was at a time when there were no limits on the length of briefs in the Supreme Court. So our briefs probably totaled 150 printed pages. The government, the president's lawyers had submitted briefs of equal length. So there was a lot to master, historical materials, cases. So Leon said he did not want to argue the case. He did not feel comfortable arguing the case. So he said, you should do this. And it was flattering. But I said, you are the special prosecutor. I think the country and the court will expect you to argue the case. So he said, how about this as a compromise? It was a little bit like the cutaway and the cowboy boots. He said, suppose we divide the argument. And the court had allowed an hour and a half per side, so a total of 3 hours, which was an enormous amount of time, given the normal traditions in Supreme Court arguments. So I said, that seemed fine to me. And we did divide it equally. Normally, when you do a Supreme Court argument, you use most of your time in your direct argument, making your points and responding to questions, and then save rebuttal time for just the wrap-up, just a small percentage. But we decided to split the time 45 minutes per side. And that's the way it unfolded. And I think, being fair, he did an excellent job given the constraints of the situation. But I think most of the commentators immediately afterward said that the tough issues had to get addressed in the rebuttal. So part of the case I argued, and it's a little bit self-serving to say that, but this is the way that he actually anticipated it would have to work out, and I think it did. And so then we waited rather breathlessly for the decision to come out.
Okay, now before we get into that, I want to know about what went on in that courtroom that day, who the judges were, what they were asking, whether you had uh-oh moments that came during this, or did you have a sense of impending victory?
There were sharp questions about the issues that we knew were vulnerable. One of them, of course, was, what's your right to be here? You're part of the executive branch, and the president has said he has made a decision that in this case, this evidence should not be pursued. And so there was a lot of back and forth.
Well, who was the cast of characters on the court itself at the time?
Well, Warren Burger was the chief justice. At the bottom end was Justice Rehnquist, who recused himself. So we had an eight-justice court.
And he recused himself because
he had been in the administration of President Nixon, in the Justice Department, in fact, as what's called the president's lawyer's lawyer. He headed the Office of Legal Counsel, which is the legal think tank in the Justice Department. So he had recused himself. And somewhat demeaningly, I think, the Chief Justice put him in charge of allocating tickets for the argument. So he was sort of like the New York City scalper for a rock concert, because there was a huge interest, a really unprecedented interest in attending the argument. And anybody who's seen the Supreme Court chamber is struck by how relatively small it is.
Tiny. Yeah.
Tiny compared to some courts, including the courtroom of the New York Court of Appeals, which is larger in terms of capacity than the U.S. Supreme Court. So Justice Rehnquist was given the responsibility for deciding who would actually get in to hear the argument. In any event, we had Justice Brennan, Justice Stewart, Justice Douglas, Justice Black, trying to go down the bench. I will say that before Cox ultimately embarked upon the decision to go after the tapes, we did a justice-by-justice headcount to figure out whether we might win That is, on the constitutional issue, does the special prosecutor have the right to get these things over a claim of executive privilege? And we had come up with the likelihood that we would get at least 5 and maybe 6 votes out of 9 at the time. We didn't know that Rehnquist would recuse himself. At the end of the argument, I think we felt better about the situation, that we would certainly, we thought we would win, even though Jim St. Clair, the president's lawyer, gave a very impassioned and very principled argument. But the tone of the questions seemed to indicate that the justices understood our position and thought that it was going to be unacceptable to agree with the president's position. And I think one of the decisive factors in what turned out to be a unanimous decision by the 8 justices, and subsequent research has shown the horse trading that went into the forming of a unanimous 8-justice court. But what I think was decisive was the political events that had intervened between the time that we first began to pursue the tapes in July of 1973 and the time the Supreme Court decided the case in July of 1974. And that was the Saturday Night Massacre and the later hearings, which depicted, at least from the perspective of one of the president's former aide,
the congressional hearings.
The congressional hearings, which were public. And I think the mood of the country cannot be ignored when one is evaluating Supreme Court decisions. There's a comment from over 100 years ago in cases that nobody in present day America would care about. The ability of America to create an overseas empire was in the aftermath of the Spanish-American War, when we seized a lot of territory from Spain, and there were a lot of issues that arose. And it was a jingoist period, and a famous New York cartoon character called Mr. Dooley commented that the Supreme Court follows the election returns. And while I wouldn't be entirely cynical about that, I think that in more recent times, we've seen with the gay marriage decision and some others, maybe even the sustaining of Obamacare, at least some of the justices are institutionally sensitive to what appears to be the popular mood on close questions or policy issues. And that, I think, is what tipped the scales in the Watergate tapes decision. By the time President Nixon got to the Supreme Court, he was in the weakest possible position politically. His legal arguments might have had a lot more heft a year earlier. And it's an accident or a corollary of history that the case turned out the way it did unanimously because of what had intervened. And the unanimity of the decision turned out to be crucial because throughout the period, President Nixon had been keeping his options open. He was pressed regularly at news conferences, "Will you abide by a decision of the Supreme Court?" And he was dangling the possibility that he would not. He would emphasize, the Supreme Court is the head of its branch. I am the head of my branch. They can decide how to run the court system. I decide how to run the executive branch. I decide what's in the interests of the presidency. And even subsequent presidents have used the same terminology to try to inflate their own personal viewpoint of what ought to be done into something of grand historical consequence.
Phil Lockevar, I love this interview, and I'm extraordinarily appreciative that you're doing it with us. But I did want to ask whether or not there was an uh-oh moment when there you were, your argument before the Supreme Court in probably one of the 10 most important cases in the history of this country, when one of the judges looked at you and asked you an uh-oh question in which you said, uh-oh.
There were a couple of not quite uh-oh questions, I'm trapped, but I wish he hadn't thought of that. And they were really very technical questions. As I mentioned, we were thinking these grand constitutional ideological thoughts. What is the structure of the political system? What does the constitutional notion of separation of powers mean? And one of the tough questions was a procedural question: what's the right of the grand jury under the applicable rule of the federal rules of criminal procedure to issue this kind of subpoena. And so our nightmare, indeed, after we left the court, our nightmare decision was that the court might say, we don't have to get to all of these tough questions. We don't have to set up a confrontation with the president by sustaining this subpoena and forcing him to choose between defying the court or turning over what potentially was damning evidence. We can get rid of this case on a technicality. Sure. This subpoena is overly broad or premature or whatever. And so that was the uh-oh moment. All of this work might go down the drain on a technicality. And all of the anguish about constitutional principle, confrontation between the branches could be evaded. And over its history, and indeed the greatest of all constitutional decisions, Marbury against Madison, is exactly that sort of sidestepping of the confrontation. Oh, we don't have the power to issue this order requiring the president to release the commission. So case gets thrown out. And we worried that by raising that question, the court would see a way of ducking the constitutional confrontation.
But I loved what you said, Phil Akbar, which is the political context, the social context of the time probably precluded that from happening. A year earlier, maybe they would have done it.
I think that's right. I think that there was so much expectation that this matter had to be resolved, couldn't be allowed to drift. I think it would have been irresponsible for the justices to have simply bailed out. They had decided to exercise extraordinary discretion to take the case. Just a complicated procedural issue. They had done what was called certiorari before judgment. They had agreed to take the case directly from the district court without an intervening decision on this dispute by the Court of Appeals. And it would have been irresponsible, having raised the national expectation that this was finally going to be resolved. Is the president entitled to the immunity that he's claiming, or must he cooperate in the investigation? And I think that's the reason that they decided that they would not look for that way of sidestepping or abandoning the issue.
Well, look, this is pretty heady stuff. So my question to you, Phil LaCavara, with all your accomplishments, which are incredible, do you ever say sort of, I was there, I did this? I mean, does it occur to you how important this was?
It comes back to me from time to time as I look back on it. But I must say, people often say that your children give you humility. One of the things that puts the frame around that argument, and by any stretch of any imagination, it was objectively the high point of my legal career, arguing, as you said, one of the cases that's identified as one of the leading cases in American history. I argued that, and I was 30 years old, I think.
Wow.
But here's the context. I mentioned earlier in our conversation that there was a lot of stress on the family, that it had indeed created some doubts about whether to take the appointment as counsel to the prosecutor. We'd been working hard, nonstop, 7 days a week for a year. My wife and I and our children had booked a one-week vacation in July in the Maryland shore, Ocean City, and it was a Sunday to Saturday of the week that the Supreme Court said, we'll hear argument on this Monday.
Wow.
So it meant that the vacation that we had planned, and again, we had seven children at the time, they're all young. The youngest at that point was two. Everybody was looking forward to this one week with Dad, and I was looking forward to my week with my wife and my children. So I dashed from the Supreme Court, went home, got out of my blue suit, got it put on my shorts, and drove to the beach with my family, talking very little about the Supreme Court argument, but about what kind of week we were going to have at the beach. So it was when we got to the beach that I began getting the news reports about what otherwise objective observers thought was the tone of the argument from the perspective of somebody sitting behind me, with the regular Supreme Court press corps, what they thought of the argument. And they were reinforcing our sense of encouragement that if the court got to the merits, we'd be doing well. But for the balance of that week, I was trying to put out of my mind.
So you actually took the vacation.
Took the vacation for the balance of the week. It was cut short by 2 days, but I went back directly from arguing the case in the Supreme Court to my house to pick up my wife and kids to go off on holiday.
So those were days, I think we forget, that we didn't have the kind of internet we have now. We certainly didn't have cell phones, right, at the time. So
no cell phones and no 24-hour news cycle with cable news or anything of the sort. There were the major networks and radio stations and newspapers, a few daily newspapers at the time. So I was dependent on what I heard on CBS News or NBC News, local affiliates, or what the press officer in our office was getting from the people in the press corps who were reporting back to him what kinds of stories they were going to be filing. So that was the evaluation that I was getting of how the argument went. It came not from fancy pants lawyers. It came from the press corps filtered through me, either through editors of newspapers or radio stations, or what reporters were telling our press officer, who would then call me up and say, well, so-and-so from the Washington Post or so-and-so from the Los Angeles Times thinks that this is the way Justice so-and-so might be leaning based on his perception of the questions and the body language and all those other tea leaves that people try to read.
Philip Lockhart, how much time did you actually have going into that Supreme Court for that argument to prepare?
Well, not very much. The court set the matter for expedited argument. So we had probably about 3 weeks to do the brief and get prepared for the argument.
So now you are, this Yiddish expression, sitting on spilkes, meaning pins and needles. You don't know what this decision is going to be. You're hopeful, but you don't know.
Exactly. We got a call from the clerk's office. It was July 24th. 1974, that the court was going to be issuing the decision that morning. The argument was held on the 10th of July. So it was 2 weeks later that the court informed us that they would be issuing the decision. So we dutifully trooped up. And as your listeners may know, the court announces decisions orally from the bench. Sometimes they will just announce the name of the case and say the judgment is affirmed. But in this case, the decision was narrated in substantial part by the Chief Justice. And that was another moment of anxiety, because Chief Justice Warren Burger, appointed by President Nixon, one of the conservatives on the court, and in some of the lower court litigation over these issues that went to the United States Court of Appeals in Washington, the Court of Appeals split liberals or Democrats in favor of the special prosecutor's arguments and the Republicans, conservatives, including the Nixon appointees, siding with the president's view of the constitutional issues. And so when the Chief Justice began to announce the decision, that might have been one of those oh no moments for me. This is not necessarily a good sign that the chief is going to be announcing the majority opinion. And we waited till he got through the decision, but the fact that he was announcing it and it became pretty clear that he was going down the line with our analyses was reassuring. We realized pretty quickly that we had prevailed. And then when he concluded by saying all of the justices concur, we realized for the first time that this was a unanimous decision. And that was extremely important, because the president had been saying he might not abide by anything other than what he called a definitive decision. And indeed, in the very last line, one of the few things that I was able to rehearse in my oral argument, like jury lawyers will tell you, jury trial lawyers will say, the one thing you have to know is your opening line before the jury and your exit line. And the opening line in a Supreme Court argument is always the same thing. Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. That's easy. The closing line that I had rehearsed, which everybody on the court understood the significance of, was, The United States asks that the court affirm the decision below firmly and definitively, period, full stop. And the unanimous decision was really the coda for this dispute about whether the president would be willing politically to defy a decision that was something that he might term non-definitive. Once all of the justices agreed, he had no bush to hide behind. He was basically politically as well as legally naked and had no choice but to turn over the tapes.
You know, I've always been fascinated, probably for no good reason, that the great Earl Warren had been a guy who tried to get his court in these big decisions to come to do unanimous decisions. And I've always wondered about how it could be that the next guy up was Warren Earl Burger as opposed to Earl Warren. But of course, that's silliness. So have we ever gotten any insight in post-Watergate tapes trial into what Burger was thinking?
Yes, indeed. Somewhat by accident, some of the papers of the justices have become public. Most of the justices leave their papers either to the Library of Congress or to a university library, but under an embargo for 50 years or until 25 years after the death of the last justice on the court for the purpose of preserving confidentiality. And footnote here, it's kind of ironic that we were asking them to overcome the confidentiality of the president's deliberations, but they go to enormous lengths to try to preserve the confidentiality of their own deliberations. In any event, papers of, I believe it was Harry Blackmun, one of the justices at the time, it did become available at the Library of Congress, and that included the memoranda that the justices circulate. They do very little in oral conversation. They have one conference, so-called, where they discuss the case, maybe for a very brief time, then all of the other communication is by memorandum or by draft opinion. And what has subsequently been recognized as a result of the access to those papers is that there was a lot of horse trading instituted by the Chief Justice, Warren Burger, in order to get a unanimous opinion. And that horse trading involved his getting his other colleagues to agree that the president is correct, that there is an executive privilege, and indeed it's a constitutionally based privilege. It isn't just an evidentiary privilege of the sort that courts created, like the marital privilege or the spousal privilege, which courts create and they decide the contours of. Burger said, if we're going to rule in favor of the special prosecutor, we at least need to say the president is right, there is an executive privilege, and it's based on the separation of powers. It flows from the structure of our national government. And the concession that he and the conservatives made was, but we'll say it's not absolute. It's not like the priest-penitent privilege or the privilege against self-incrimination. It can be overridden, except in matters of national security or state secrets. So if it's merely designed to protect confidentiality and candor in the executive office in the White House, it can be overridden if there's a showing of a compelling need to get at it. And so I said after the decision came out that we won the battle. Richard Nixon lost the battle, but the presidency won the war. Because every president since Nixon has invoked executive privilege to withhold documents from courts, from the press, and from Congress. Yeah. And they have said, on the basis of United States versus Nixon, we've got a constitutional privilege to protect the confidentiality of our conversation. So the presidency, as this is President Nixon's biggest legacy to the presidency, as he kept saying, the court, as part of the internal horse trading, agreed to hold that there is an executive privilege, and it's based on the Constitution, but it could be overridden, as it was in Watergate, but every other president has managed to take advantage of it.
Phil Lacovara, I guess I want to go to a little bit of an ancillary thing, but only because you're such a great Supreme Court scholar, and that is that, as you just implied, the court itself has been a little secretive for many of us. You know, the idea that we can't see what they're doing, that we can't see them on television while they're making their announcements and like that. I'm wondering what your insight into that is. How important is that for them and for us?
It's almost become an article of faith for them. It's, I think, interesting that in this era, they are still as resistant to cameras in the courtroom as they are. And I think virtually all of the justices, left and right, are in accord with that approach. And their fear is that people will play to the cameras. They will be even more theatrical in their questions if they're going to be on television, because they are, after all, human and like to be, at least some of them, the argument goes, like to be seen. Others, and the late Justice Scalia was one of these, who would make the opposite point to oppose having cameras in the courtroom. They like to be able to be anonymous, some of them. That is, they like not to be recognized if they're going out in public. They recognize that they're making a lot of controversial decisions. Now, sadly, we live in times when what would otherwise be unthinkable is almost commonplace.
Yeah, but tough darts, because the congressmen do that too. They took the job. Why not?
I think that's a fair argument. You could also say that the justices are probably least
political.
Well, yeah. I was going to say least likely to be targeted by assassins or terrorists, because most of them have marshals to protect them.
Although at least one potboiler written and sold millions of copies based on that whole premise.
Yeah, yeah. There are lots of arguments why cameras should be allowed in the courtroom. One is the argument of transparency. Why shouldn't the public see what this vitally important branch of the government is doing? The argument that it will affect the quality of their performance or the nature of their behavior seems to me to be overblown. They are mature people. This is not like a jury trial where you might worry that jurors will be affected by the presence of cameras
or the witnesses,
on them,
or witnesses.
Or witnesses will either be intimidated or will become shy or will be grandstanding. So I think it is fundamentally different. And many other appellate courts do allow cameras in the courtroom. I believe the new Supreme Court of England and Wales has just decided to allow cameras in the courtroom. But as I say, despite repeated suggestions that there be an opening of cameras in the Supreme Court chamber, at least for the announcement of decisions, even if not for oral argument, most of the justices have been adamant in drawing the line. There has been a little bit of movement.
Yes, it has.
Originally, there weren't even transcripts of arguments available until long afterwards. And while recordings were made, they were rarely accessible. Now, recordings are made available almost instantly, so one can actually hear the argument and the justices' questions. But that's, I'm hesitant to say this on a radio station, but there is something like the visual that adds a dimension that merely the recording doesn't convey.
Right you are. I guess I want to go back to the case itself. You made one point about Nixon lost the case but won the war in terms of presidential privilege. But I guess I want to know, in history, the way you evaluate this case, how important?
I think it's a pivotal case intrinsically and collaterally. Intrinsically, it's extremely important because of its immediate effect. The president, when he announced that he would comply within a short time with the decision, made the tapes available to his close advisors, and they insisted that they had never heard these tapes until after the Supreme Court decision, and they convinced him that he could not survive the impending impeachment once these tapes became public and would be turned over to the prosecutors and eventually to the Congress. And so within a matter of 2 weeks following the Supreme Court's decision, the president had resigned, the first and only time in American history, and he resigned solely as a result of the Supreme Court's decision. That makes this a pivotal decision. Pivotal also in what it decided with respect to presidential power. As I mentioned, the Supreme Court held there is executive privilege, that is the right to protect discussions in the executive branch in almost all cases. And every president since then has availed himself of that privilege to withhold information from Congress, from the courts, and from the public in a variety of circumstances. So this has added a new weapon in the arsenal of presidential power, or what some call the imperial presidency. So the immediate consequences were significant historically, and the constitutional consequences long range were important. The collateral consequences, I think, are perhaps even more grave. Watergate, the litigation over the Nixon tapes and the surrounding press coverage and public skepticism changed the nature of the political system and the nature of the relationship between the press and government. The press and the government have now a much more hostile, arm's length, skeptical relationship. The other part of it, which I think is less appreciated, is 1974 was another sea change in congressional government. The so-called class of 1974 consisted of a lot of young Turks, people who were elected as part of the backlash against Watergate, against what now is being called in the current electoral cycle the establishment, or the Bernie Sanders or Donald Trump reaction against the establishment. 1974 involved a brand new class, huge number of new members of Congress, of the House of Representatives and the Senate, who basically dismantled the seniority system that had been in place for generations. The Young Turks, who were elected in 1974, said, "We're not going to take our instructions from these people who are chairmen of committees or subcommittees who got to these positions solely on the basis of having survived long enough to be seniors. We have our own voices." One of the corollaries of that revolution of 1974 in Congress is the gridlock that we see today. Lyndon Johnson, we were talking about Lyndon Johnson having taped his conversations in the White House. We've heard some of the things that he did to get the Civil Rights Act passed in 1974. He called the chairman of the relevant committees and twisted their arms, and they had the ability to tell their committees, fall in line, we're going to get these civil rights bills out on the floor. And on the floor, the leaders could command the votes to get things done. That system changed fundamentally in 1974, and we are inheriting the aftermath of it for good or ill. Everybody now gets to decide for himself what he's going to do, whether he's going to vote for something. And leadership is a matter largely of honor rather than power. We've seen that in the last several speakers of the House on the Republican side. We saw it largely as well on the Democratic side when Nancy Pelosi was Speaker of the House. But I think it's one of those political consequences of Watergate and that 1974 political disruption that has had significant lingering and possibly negative effects on our political system.
There was 18 minutes missing from the Watergate tapes.
Yes.
Arlo Guthrie claims that the president was listening to Alice's Restaurant during that time. We dismiss that. Can you tell us anything about the 18 minutes?
Well, there were enormous efforts with lots of sound engineers and others to try to recoup the 18 minutes that were erased from the audio tape. And all I can say is, at the time, the best engineers tried to do it. There was no way to retrieve what was on there. I think almost any honest observer would conclude that the erasures were deliberate and either were done by the president himself, which I think is highly plausible, or at least were done by his secretary at his instruction. Given the fact that so much absolutely damning information was left on the tapes, it almost beggars the imagination to try to speculate about
how bad
what
that
might have been in 18 minutes that the president decided to censor. that was in some way qualitatively different from everything that was left.
Astounding.
It really is. He didn't destroy the tapes either when their existence was first announced.
Should he have, Phil? If you were he, should the president, in order to have avoided impeachment and everything else, said burn the damn things?
If I were he and if I thought that there was any chance that the Supreme Court would ultimately order me to turn them over and any chance that the decision would be unanimous, leaving me with no political option to disobey, I would say yes, destroy them. Because if he had destroyed them almost up until the Supreme Court decision, he might have been able to escape impeachment and he would have continued to serve his term, because there would have been enough lingering support from his adherents to accept his argument that he was acting not in self-preservation, but for the presidency, to preserve the integrity of the presidential office for successors to come. So I think certainly if he had done it at the very early stages in 1973, early on, there's, in my view, no doubt but that he would have survived to complete his term.
So only because I love this part of my life, and that is that, you know, we meet up, you and I, we meet up in the New York City Police Department. And you were running things at a time when there was a general feeling that if you turn over a rock, there was going to be a corrupt policeman. You had a commissioner who brings you on. And I remember you throwing me out of your office. We shared an office, but getting thrown out because Serpico was coming in or David Dirk was coming in during that time. That was heady stuff, wasn't it?
It was extremely heady stuff. I do have to say, I don't remember throwing you out.
Well, you asked me. I think, said, Alan, could you leave us now?
I think I may have asked politely for opportunity to chat privately with someone.
Right, that's right.
But it was heady times. Just for background, New York City was involved in one of its periodic corruption scandals. This one seemed to be larger than some in the then recent past. There was a special investigating committee that had been appointed, and the mayor, John Lindsay, decided that it was time to bring in a reform police commissioner, and he brought back a former relatively low-ranking New York City police officer, Patrick V. Murphy, who I think had risen as high as lieutenant before he'd gone off to join a couple of other police departments in executive positions. And he was brought back in as the commissioner. And he was the first non-lawyer police commissioner in a good number of years. And I think the mayor's office may have suggested to him, I'd like to think that he agreed with it, that it might be useful to have a young lawyer who might help him
with impeccable credentials
analyze things. Yeah. Well, somebody, I don't know whether what the credentials were that they were looking for, but I wound up getting recommended to him by...
As counsel.
As counsel. The title was special counsel. Originally, the title was going to be special assistant to the police commissioner, and that struck me as being, for a young lawyer, a little bit too vague. And I was not at all clear, having recently started a career in private law practice, that I wanted to burn bridges in pursuing a career at the law.
What year is this?
That was 1971.
Okay, 1971.
Early 1971. So I said, I'd like to at least preserve my identity as a lawyer. Now, there already was an office in the police department, a deputy commissioner's position, the deputy commissioner for legal matters, which turned out to involve some other awkwardness because I came in working directly in the police commissioner's office with the title special counsel to the police commissioner, and the deputy commissioner resented having some youngster coming in with apparently greater access to the commissioner than he had. But it was a time of police corruption, but in addition, it was another time of transition in American society. The civil rights movement was in full gear, so there were the issues of recruiting minorities, particularly blacks, to a lesser degree at the time, Hispanics, into the NYPD. It was also the time of the women's movement, and believe it or not, there was an issue about whether the police department would be opened up to a larger realm of opportunity for women.
Boy, was there ever, and I remember the wives of officers did not want those guys riding around with female police officers.
Well, it was a multidimensional controversy, and again, people in 2016 can hardly imagine some of the cross currents there. One of the main lines of resistance to the effort to open up the NYPD to more women. And at the time, the New York City law provided that there would be basically two police departments, one with the entry level being for patrol men, underscore men, and there would be a police woman's bureau, which was limited to 300 police women. And at the time, there were roughly 27,000 police officers. Now I think it's 35,000. But there was this very sharp distinction in terms of police women and patrolmen, and a very small number of women authorized. But one of the lines of resistance, apart from the worries of
the wives,
of having their husbands in close proximity on the particularly on the midnight to 8 a.m. shifts, were all sorts of shenanigans were at least imaginable.
Well, some of them turned out right to be justified. Not many, but some, yeah.
Yeah, well, in any workplace situation,
you bet.
Romance is possible. And I think some of the scenes you should see on TV shows where you've got male and female partners, you see that the relationship when you're on the front line and your life is in the hands of the person sitting next to you in a radio car, that can form a very intense relationship, and sometimes it can get out of hand. But the other, perhaps less expected line of resistance came from the minority community. I remember one meeting with a group of women, and in the room was the deputy commissioner for community affairs, who at the time was black, and the women's group representatives were pressing for breaking down this discriminatory barrier to opportunities for women in the NYPD. And his reaction was, just at the time that my people are getting opportunities, you want to bring in a whole new class of competitors. And I don't know that that's really good for the New York City community. Now, ultimately, it took a long time for the police department to be opened up to women, but now anybody who goes around New York or in almost any other police department will see women carrying an equal share of the policing responsibility.
So there you were, being a young man, a counsel to the PC police commissioner. And I remember there were these two women who had gained somewhat of a reputation for analyzing all this stuff. They were scholars. Those are the kinds of people you had to deal with every day.
Oh, yeah. It was enormous fun. The range of things that we had to deal with at the time included the array of civil rights issues. It was also the incipient period of terrorism, both international terrorism and racially motivated terrorism. We had the so-called Black Liberation Army. In 1 year, if I remember correctly, six policemen were assassinated in what appeared to be quasi-racial, quasi-terrorist killings of policemen. But there was litigation between the city and the American Civil Liberties Union over the NYPD's intelligence division, mm-hmm. which was at the time a significant part of the underground of policing. And the intelligence division tried to keep tabs not only on gangsters, the mafia and related gangs, but also foreign terrorists, foreign intelligence agencies, that is, spies in the conventional sense, and the newly emerging network of terrorism. And among the things that were being challenged were things that continue to trouble the political debate today, that is, to what degree do you monitor mosques? Even back in the 1970s, there was a sense that some aspect of Muslim ideology might inspire some people to engage in terrorism as a route to pursuing the goals that they saw for their religion. And this was viewed at the time by some observers as being un-American, dangerous, inconsistent with freedom of religion. So there were issues of that sort that were percolating at the time. Where to draw lines? How do you balance cherished liberty against legitimate security?
Here today, as you say. So what about the characters? There is Frank Serpico, ends up with a bullet in his head because allegedly his fellow officers wouldn't come because they thought he had ratted them out or something like that. So how was that?
Well, the context was that corruption had become endemic in the police department. And the police commissioner used to say it starts with the free cup of coffee at the diner, and then it involves taking a few dollars from the local numbers runner, and then, gee, maybe taking a few more dollars from the person who's just selling some marijuana.
Well, there are stories in the paper as we speak about a single very young prostitute having prostituted herself with a number of high-ranking police officers.
Yeah. What was the corrosive aspect of corruption is that very few people start out taking bribes to let murderers go.
Yeah, sure.
It is corrosive. It builds little by little, and not everybody goes from taking a free cup of coffee to becoming a lookout for the local dope dealers. But it is, unfortunately, a process that did proceed with too much regularity. And then not only did you have corruption in the sense of people taking bribes, but there also were incidents of outright direct criminality. For example, one of the most notorious incidents at the time was a report from one of the precincts in the meatpacking district of a possible burglary. And there had been a break-in at a meatpacking plant. And as subsequent investigation showed, three or four radio cars responded to the scene, and police officers, with no fear of being turned in by their colleagues, began helping themselves to frozen meats and putting them in the trunks of their squad cars. Now, this was an illustration of just how bad the situation had gotten, that the cops were becoming the criminals. And most disturbingly, there seemed to be a culture in which it was unthinkable that you would turn in one of your fellow officers, even if you knew that he was a criminal.
Do you suspect the same stuff goes on today?
I think the same stuff goes on today. I really think it's less pervasive. Maybe that's just my own sense of naive optimism. But I think there are controls that are in place today that weren't in place at the time that you and I worked in the NYPD. They've got a bit of more infiltration, the so-called field associates program, where people directly from the police academy are recruited to become undercover operatives, that is, to try to be groomed to be honest, but also to be looking out for and reporting any signs of corruption that they see among their colleagues. And that, of course, gets us back to the Frank Serpico situation, because the culture had been, you don't rat on your friends, and we're all out here together. It's the blue wall, and it's us versus them, and we have to stand together. And that means the honest people even have to stand together with the crooks, if the crooks are wearing blue. And Frank Serpico, kind of an odd character, certainly an atypical police officer whose background made him a bit of a loose cannon in many respects, at some point got disgruntled with this system and began talking about corruption that he was experiencing, particularly in the gambling area, to some degree narcotics as well. And he and his partner were on a raid at one point, and he wound up getting shot in the face, and there was a good deal of suspicion, including on his part, that he'd been set up for a possible assassination by his fellow officers. And Serpico was ultimately discovered by the prosecutors, the federal prosecutors, working with the New York Police Task Force on corruption, and was used with a good deal of effectiveness in going back out on the street to identify problems that were tangible and ultimately prosecutable, and he did so at great personal risk. He'd already taken a bullet for being willing to buck the system, and yet he was willing to go back out and put himself on the line to do this for a while longer. I remember the day when we finally gave him the gold shield of a detective. And he, I think with legitimate foundation, resented the fact that the day that he was given this shield in a ceremony at police headquarters, he was one of seven or eight people who, for different reasons, service, heroism, or whatever, were also promoted to detective. And in a way, it submerged or diluted the unique contribution that he had been making to helping to root out corruption when he was given a promotion just along in a batch with a bunch of other people.
Well, we're out of time, but I have to say, Phil LaCavara, you have to come back and do another 5 hours with me. And the reason is that there's so much more, for example, in the police area that we could talk about. I love Law and Order, and there's always a guy on Law and Order who is the investigator, for the investigating the cops. And they treat him as if this guy is the worst person, whoever was. He's always portrayed that way. So we could talk about that and a lot more. Phil LaCavara, what a great gift you have given all of us here by talking about this. All of your wonderful reminiscences of Watergate, the police department, and you've always been a hero to me, and you still are. Thank you so much for being with us.
Alan, you're too kind. Great to be with you again.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.